Hello and welcome to Healing From Within. I am your host, Cheryl Glick, author of Life is No Coincidence, The Life and Afterlife Connection, and also The Living Spirit, a tale of healing energies, spiritual communication, miracles, and of course, a guide to soul awareness. I am most delighted to welcome once again a favorite guest of mine, Nick Redfern, author of his newest book, 365 Days of UFOs. Hello, Nick, and our listeners are ready, I believe, for more insights into the world beyond worlds and life within that guides us to appreciate open-minded approaches to all new information and experiences.
Well, thanks for having me on, Cheryl.
All right. And as listeners of Healing From Within are well aware, there is more to be seen beyond the focus of our ordinary five physical senses and more to be known energetically. As we continue to evolve and use technology and our inner intuitiveness, we will discover we are much more than our physical bodies. And then we can reevaluate what is thought to be true by our mind or ego, and we may find what may be quite a different reality beyond the three-dimensional physical life we are presently engaged in. In today's episode of Healing From Within, Nick Redfern, author of 40 books, including Women in Black, Men in Black, and The Weapons of the Gods and Bloodlines of the Gods, which we have discussed on previous shows, is dedicated to sharing stories, many stories, one for each day of the year and from all parts of our planet, about UFOs, military pilots, extraterrestrials, face-to-face encounters with them, and crashed flying saucers, and so many stories. Nick, you know, I always love to have my guests share a moment of their beginning, their interests in the work and values they now do as adults, and perhaps someone or some event that may have been really important to them. And that have influenced you and you to excel at the work that you're doing today. So what would that be?
Well, what actually got me interested in the subject, Cheryl, and I wouldn't be doing what I do now if it wasn't for this, is that my dad was in the British Royal Air Force. He was a radar mechanic with the military. And back at the height of the Cold War, he was involved in several UFO incidents where very high-flying, fast-moving objects were approaching the British East coastline. And the first thought was, you know, it's got to be some sort of sneak, either attack or penetration of our airspace by the Russians. Because, you know, at the height of the Cold War, that was the obvious assumption. And so fighter planes were sent up from a nearby Air Force base to try and intercept them. And the pilots reported seeing these very bright lights, which was like extremely bright, almost like a camera flash in intensity, but sort of staying on all the time. And as the planes would close in on them, these large balls of light would sort of shoot out of the area. And in some cases, actually, arrive again behind the aircraft as if they were playing like a game of cat and mouse with them. And this went on for about 3 or 4 hours, and to a point where the planes had to return to base to refuel. And then the second night and the third night, the same thing happened again. This sort of squadron of these strangely brightly lit objects, clearly under some sort of intelligent control, but performing all sorts of weird maneuvers, like traveling at 800 or 900 miles an hour, and then suddenly coming to a complete stop, you know, not even sort of slowing down, just, you know, 1 minute they're doing this speed, and then the next minute they're hovering at like 20,000 feet. And on the final night, when there actually wasn't any more reports, my dad and everybody involved was told, you won't talk about this, you know, you'll keep quiet, and you've signed the British government's Official Secrets Act, as it's called. And my dad didn't tell me till I was about 12 or 13, something like that. And that really got me interested in the subject. And I began reading books on it and, you know, looking further into mysteries beyond just UFOs as well. And so that's sort of really what got me involved. And had it not been for my dad's own encounter in the military, I may have developed an interest in it, but I doubt I probably would have, you know, gone down the path that I have now. So.
Well, in your new book, 365 Days of UFOs, there are other military people who, like mm-hmm. your dad, in different places in the world,
yep.
who have also been silenced and who have also had to wait a long time before they were able to express this to people they love. And once you have an experience, we all know, there's no one who's going to take that away from you. There's no one who's going to be able to tell you it's not true, because
that's
it's
right.
part of your
right.
being after that. And that's why it's wonderful that you share so many stories, different types of stories in the book. But let's go on to, what is the theme of 365 Days of UFOs, and how did you research or find so many incidents?
Well, the theme of the book, it's called 365 Days of UFOs because I wanted to do something a little bit different. You know, it's when I've done sort of so many books, like about 40 altogether now, 41, the challenge is to sort of come up with something new, you know, and every year it gets a little bit more difficult. And so I thought, well, instead of doing books that I've written, like books I've written before, where they're all on one particular subject, like Bloodlines of the Gods or Men in Black, that kind of thing. So I thought, well, instead of making the theme of the book one subject, why not make the theme of it like a calendar of UFOs? So that's what I did. I sort of decided to write this book, which the publisher liked the idea of a book on 365 days of UFOs. And so, you know, then the challenge was, well, which cases do I use? Now, obviously, you know, I've sort of included the well-known ones like Roswell and the Rendlesham Forest case in England, and like the Betty and Barney Hill alien abduction case. But, you know, as well as being a writer of books, I'm also a reader of books, and you want to be able to give the reader something new. So what I deliberately did in the book was to include a lot of very largely obscure and little known cases, because I thought people would like that, find that more interesting than simply going over all the same old cases that everybody's heard of.
Yes, so that was a good idea. And you know, the consistency and large body of evidence makes it more clear that this phenomenon mm-hmm. we're talking about, you know, UFOs and extraterrestrial life. And recently, I just read they found 7 new planets.
Yeah.
You were reading about that also, I'm sure. Is real, and it's worth talking about, because, you know, nothing in life is random. There is a grand universal plan. And on this planet, we have so many different forms of animal and plant life, right? So much diversity. So why would we think that the universe didn't hold diversity and different types of life forms? It would be almost ludicrous to think that. So that you bring attention in your work to this is a very good thing, because we must keep an open mind. In previous books, you have suggested evidence of some hostile alien events in centuries past. Can you tell us something about that, and how knowing that may help us to deal with future encounters with alien life forms? Because it's going to happen.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, clearly the vast majority of the UFO phenomenon hasn't sort of proved to be hostile. You know, most cases either, sometimes people are frightened, which is quite natural, but they don't exhibit outright hostility. But there have been some cases like that. For example, I talk about one from 1953, where two pilots, Carl Hunrath and Wilbur Wilkinson, took to the skies of Southern California in an aircraft. They said that they'd been contacted, or they'd made contact with human-like aliens in the California desert, and they were flying out on another occasion to meet them at a remote desert location. And they took off from this little small airport just outside of LA, and they were never seen again. They'd rented a plane from the airstrip and were never seen or found again. The aircraft was not seen again. No wreckage was found, no sign of them. And despite extensive searches all around the immediate, and actually sort of long distance area, nothing at all was ever found. And so it's a very mysterious case. And of course, some people take the view that they were either kidnapped or the plane was destroyed, but we really don't know. But there are a few cases like that where UFOs have exhibited sort of hostility in proximity to aircraft. Now, in some cases, that's when aircraft have reportedly opened fire on them. So I guess in those circumstances, you can't really blame them, for responding. Yeah, we just don't know what the answer really is. So,
Right.
it's one of these situations where, we can say for sure we've never had sort of a, an Independence Day or War of the Worlds type situation because we would
No.
know about it. It's certainly the case, as you said, that the vast majority of the reports aren't hostile. Sometimes the phenomenon is very overly evasive where, they don't always want to sort of show themselves to us openly all the time. But, they're on the other side of the coin, they're not, as far as we can tell, ready to destroy us or anything like
That's
that.
wonderful. I'm going to hope for that forever and ever. That even if we coexist in the silence of the night, in different realms or planets, that we can be cooperative and respect the other life form. So I'm going to send that intention out all the time. Now, in your search for elusive creatures, what might be one for you that was one of the most unique creatures described in the book? I have one, but you tell me one.
Well, I would say at least one of them would be the sightings that began in 1966 in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, which is the Mothman sightings. And that's a subject that's interested me since I actually really got into the subject. When I was about 13, I read John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies. Now, although some people suggest this was just some sort of strange creature and there was no UFO angle, that's actually not true. When the sightings of Mothman in Point Pleasant were at their height from 66 to 67, there were a lot of UFO encounters in and around the town. And a lot of the people who'd seen the Mothman were visited by the men in black and warned not to talk about what they'd seen. So I'm quite interested in a lot of these stories where strange creatures have been seen at the same time and in the same location as UFOs and men in black and other strange paranormal phenomena, which I think a lot of this is sort of interconnected and interlinked. And I've been to Point Pleasant several occasions, and people still see the Mothman to this day in and around town, but
Now,
they just don't really talk about the cases that much. They just don't want, the press knocking on their door or whatever.
well, some things are better left to nature and to unfold in its own way. But I saw the movie, The Mothman. Is that the Mothman we're talking about? Who is like a prophecy of a happening, an event that's going to happen, and then nothing can stop it?
Yeah, it's described as like a shadowy humanoid figure with large wings and these sort of bright, fiery red eyes. And it's sort of almost like a not something that causes the disasters, but it appears when disaster is about to occur,
Yes.
if it's sort of what like a warning type creature.
It's like people have dreams, and then sometimes someone passes, intuitive people pick up. I have come to the conclusion of my interactions as a medium and downloading a lot of messages for people that are accurate. That nothing is bad and nothing is good. It's just events and learning experiences for us. And we each have as much time on this planet in this lifetime as we contracted. Like we have a time to come and a time to go, and it's not bad because life is eternal and it goes on. Energy can't be destroyed, and our soul is pure energy. So I was frightened by seeing that movie, The Mothman. But now when I think about it in a different way, I think, well, might not an angel come and give us a destiny, a plan for an event happening? And would that be a bad thing? Or a way to prepare and then deal lovingly or consciously without fear with what happened. So I have to rethink that a little bit now, that movie that I saw after what you just said and what we're talking about here, because everything has a good side and a negative side if you look at it that way. But if you look at it as just events meant to help us to know ourselves better, then it's neither. So I like to try to think of it that way. Now let's go on to you relate stories from countries all over the world. Where do you think the most events have happened, and why might that area have been selected by aliens to focus their attention on? Now you just talked about where the Mothman was. That was an area he was has been seen over and over. He might have a proclivity towards that area for some reason, nature-wise or temperature-wise or any other reason for it. So, what can you say about that?
Well, in terms of the number of reports, it's hard to say because now I would say probably, the more advanced countries in the world are the ones where we get more reports from. But whether or not that's because there are actually more sightings, or it may be because people have a better ability to report them. I mean, I'll give you an example. We know from researchers who have sort of travelled 30 or 40 years ago into sort of the depths of like Brazil and Argentina and Chile and countries like that in South America, that they uncovered dozens and dozens, in some cases hundreds of reports. But a lot of the people, lived in little poor villages and they didn't have phones. So it was only when the researchers found them out that they could share their stories. So it's hard to say really, if the number of reports is bigger here than anywhere else, or
Well,
is it
yeah.
just the ability to report on them,
That's good, yeah. And Nick, I know you give many stories from Canada, Europe, and England, and the United States, and South America. It's really all over the world.
Well, the reason I did that was actually to demonstrate that particular fact to the reader that, rather than focus on one or two countries, which might, for new readers, might make them think that, oh, this is just a phenomenon local to one area, what I wanted to do was, show that UFOs occur worldwide. So I've got reports from the US, the UK, France, Poland, Brazil, Argentina, there's New Zealand, Australia, Canada, you
All
name it, all
over.
over the place, so
Yes,
everywhere, yeah.
that's why I asked you that question, so that the people can see that this is
Yeah.
a very broad area that we're covering. Now, you tell of people actually seeing corpses of aliens, but not being allowed to discuss this. Can you tell us of an incident? I particularly am aware of one in Dayton, Ohio, with Harry Palmer. You may want to talk about that one or another one.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is an interesting aspect of the UFO phenomenon where, reports of UFOs crashing to Earth and then military getting out there and recovering these things. And, obviously that if even just one UFO has ever crashed, that material evidence would be so valuable it would never be destroyed. So, that not only would the wreckage be kept, some attempts would be made to try and preserve the bodies that were found in the wreckage, so we have a lot of reports, surprisingly large number from military personnel who claim to have seen sort of preserved alien bodies, sometimes in sort of bad states of, they've been obviously been in an accident. Other cases, they look quite, in full shape, and they're preserved either in sort of like a frozen cryogenic type tanks or preserved in preservation liquids. Now, the one you talk about, who I, in the book I call Harry Palmer, he was adamant. He was one of the few people in the book who didn't want his real name using. But he told me of a case that he was directly involved in from January the 10th, 1988, when he was under very odd circumstances. He's actually shown these bodies deep below Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in sort of a secure bunker, and the bodies were laid out in these particular strange-looking cylinders. Clearly, the bodies were in a state of preservation, and they were small bodies with oversized heads. But what he found most intriguing of all, not just the fact that he was being shown this, but why he was being shown it, he didn't really understand that. And the only conclusion he came to was that perhaps the government was subtly actually wanting the story to come out to prepare people slowly. So what they would do, they would find specific military personnel that they would target and expose them to the bodies, knowing that at some point in their life they would probably talk about it with their families and friends. And it would sort of subtly and slowly get across to people that, wow, this is really happening. And so if the truth comes out, it wouldn't be such of a shock. So in other words, he may have been deliberately exposed to see these bodies to, as I said, to get the word out bit by bit. And maybe that was the,
maybe
the end of all these things.
You're absolutely right. I was going to ask you why they took him down to that
level.
There was
no other, there was no actual logical reason for shoving him other than the fact that, you know, they wanted to get his reaction, I think. And then also they knew that perhaps 10 years after retirement, he's going to talk about it and the people he tells are going to talk about it. And if they're doing that with 30 or 40, 50 people a year, the story is going to come out more to where it won't be such a shock. You know?
Absolutely. Now, you tell a story about spying on aliens on the moon and mention Ingo Swann, who was considered to be one of the U.S. government's leading remote viewers. Unique individuals, psychic powers, and ESP were used to spy on, you know, other countries. And as a medium myself who downloads information from a unified field of energy, long ago I was curious about remote viewing, and I ended up attending a conference in Arizona, and we had an exercise.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was cool because I knew I was doing readings and getting information, so I didn't know the difference of what remote viewing was. So we had an exercise, and two people took an item. They went in a car, and we had to, any way we could, pick up on the information where they were. And for me, it was much like the information I receive about a person when I focus on a specific person. And I did see the place they went to. It seemed to be a religious center. There was a circular driveway and a stone bench, had a double doorway and a plaque above the bench. So, and inside I saw a round rotunda, so it seemed to be a place where people would maybe sing, and that's where they went. I didn't get the name, but I got the description. And that's what remote viewing is, downloading information. So now Swann proved to be a highly skilled remote viewer. And then she worked with someone named Mr. Axelrod. I found the story very interesting because this was a while ago, right?
Oh, yeah, this was back in the 1970s, a particular case that I talk about. And as you said, Ingo Swann was one of the leading remote viewers, to the extent that he was actually secretly invited by the military to get involved in their research into what in simple terms you would call sort of psychic spying, you know, on the enemy, sort of trying to psychically spy on the Kremlin or in China, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was on one particular occasion, Swann was contacted under sort of very sort of like cloak and dagger circumstances, and he was invited to meet a man who gave the name of Mr. Axelrod, but almost certainly that probably wasn't his real name. And he was actually first driven, then flown in a helicopter where he was actually blindfolded and then taken to some sort of military installation, still blindfolded, and they went down some sort of elevator. He could feel, you know, they were dropping, so they're clearly in some sort of underground facility. And he was then able to take off this the blinds, and there were a number of people there. Mr. Axelrod introduced himself and said he would like Ingo Swann to try and remote view the moon. And he didn't specifically say why, but he showed him a couple of specific books that were all about, I mean, just regular books that you could buy in any store, I mean, that were about aliens on the moon. And then Ingo Swann realized, you know, what the whole goal was. There was Mr. Axelrod and his team had beliefs or a suspicion or knew that there was something of an alien nature on the moon, but they didn't know what it was, and they wanted Swann to try and find out. And apparently when Swann remote viewed this particular area of the moon they were interested in, he found evidence of some sort of underground facility, like a massive installation underground, not on the surface. And also reports of very human-looking aliens in this facility. Now, where it got a little bit sinister is that Ingo Swann said that as he was remote viewing them and seeing these aliens, it was as if they suddenly realized they were being watched, and they then turned the tables on to him. And Mr. Axelrod immediately told him to break the connection, as if they were, you know, it was almost like the police trying to track down a phone call, you know, and trace it back to one location. And so it was a little bit of a sinister situation from that perspective. But when the remote viewing process was finished, basically Mr. Axelrod thanked Ingo Swann, paid him very nicely, and he never heard from him again. He was evidently satisfied by what Swann had seen on the or under the surface of the moon.
Yes, he was able to retrieve some important or validate some important information, which is a great thing to be able to do. Now, the Cold War with the Soviet Union was long thought to have been gone, but with this continuing dialogue of the media trying to make us think that they had something to do with the 2016 election, it seems like the world is a very dangerous place, fueled by fake news and political insurgents, and to make matters worse, rather than calmly working towards the common good of all. So tell us what you think about any of this. The Chinese hackers, Vladimir Putin, atomic arsenals in the heart of Europe, terrorist attacks, North Korea. What are we to do, and how are we to think, and how can we teach our children to value honesty and truth and possible new life forms, aliens? What do we need to do at this time to get a fix on this?
Well, the problem we have today that we didn't really have, or certainly nowhere near as much as we did, you know, say even 10 years ago, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, is that we don't know, the problem is today, we don't know what's true and what isn't.
Yes.
You know, it's like we back in the Second World War, we knew that Adolf Hitler was the enemy, and we knew exactly what he wanted to do, you know, and their troops were, you know, the Nazis had their own uniforms, and, you know, America had its particular uniforms, the UK soldiers had their uniforms, and you knew who you were fighting and why you were fighting. Now, today, we don't really know what's going on, where it's happening, where, how many multiple agendas there are at work, and really, you know, you read the news or watch the news, and you're not really sure if what you're getting is actually news, or is it something that's geared towards a specific agenda rather than just actually reporting on the news, which is what used to be done, you know.
Yes.
So I think that's the biggest problem that I see at all, is this issue of not really knowing what the truth is. And when you don't know what the truth is, it's hard then to sort of really make an opinion, you know.
I want to thank you, Nick Redfern, for your continued search for understanding the past, present, and future needs of all life, alien life, life here on the planet. Indeed, as we search for truth and wisdom, how to discern all the 365 days of UFOs, to see the many similarities between the stories related from people of all cultures and nations across our planet. To read more about this and purchase the book, go to Nick Redfern 14, FORTEAN .blogspot.com. In summarizing today's episode of Healing From Within, we have spanned decades and continents, covering numerous stories relating to UFO sightings, crashes, face-to-face encounters with extraterrestrials, and we've learned more about the importance of using this accurate information, truthful information, not fake news, to make our planet a safer and better planet or place for humanity to evolve, and understand that worlds that exist may be unlike ours, and that life forms on our planet take many shapes and sizes, but perhaps all serve a purpose in the universe, and none are more worthy to live a good life. We are all worthy of life. Nick and I would have you explore this world with its many imperfections and challenges. in hopes of allowing, accepting, and surrendering to all that happens in a good way, without fear and judgment, violence, or negativity, for all experiences are necessary to broaden our awareness of energy and life, both here and beyond. Then we can act with hope in discovering how to live in harmony and peace and ensure that the future, which Nick and I spoke about today, will be a wonderful place for all people from whatever nation, race, religion, gender, or sexual persuasion, or planet other than this one, may engage with thoughtfulness, courage, and cooperation to advance all without harming any. I am Cheryl Glick, host of Healing From Within, and invite you to visit my website, CherylGlick.com, to listen to and read about metaphysical studies and the origin of life, human nature, the mysteries of the universe, science and spirituality, the arts and education, in order to better understand self and to create your most successful life journey. Shows may also be heard on WebTalkRadio.net and DreamVision7Radio.com. Thank you.